say that I don't give a damn. Come on, baby, don't you want
Buddy to Guy. Me. Buddy Guy doesn't give a damn. Welcome back to the show, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. And that is the legendary Buddy Guy performing at the Crossroads Festival. There is a new book called Waiting for Buddy Guy, Chicago Blues at the Crossroads. And the author of that book is a man named Alan Harper. And we have a link for all the information about the book and Alan on our Facebook page, facebook.com/Nick D Show. And here to talk about this terrific book is Alan Harper. Alan, good morning, sir.
Good morning, Nick. How are you?
All right. How are you?
I'm not too bad. I mean, for me, it's 9:30 in the morning, and I've walked the dog and had breakfast, and everything's fine, whereas for you, I guess it's not quite like that.
It's not quite like that. It's around 3:35 a.m. here. So, but that's okay. Listen, where are we here? Where are you in England?
I am in a little town called Totnes, which is in the southwest. It's an old market town founded by the Normans about 1,000 years ago, surrounded by green fields.
Must be beautiful.
It is, actually. It's very wet. That's why it's green. But it's okay.
Okay. Where are you originally? Are you originally from there, Alan, or where were you from?
It's slightly mixed up history. Born in Scotland, and like so many people of my generation, I'm 57. My parents moved abroad, so I was brought up in Nairobi and sent back to school in England when I reached a certain age. And, you know, it went from there, university in England, and that's really where I got into the blues.
How did that happen, Alan? Tell us about how you got into the blues. Was it the British white guys playing the blues that you originally got into?
It was. It was people like the Rolling Stones and Eric Clapton and Led Zeppelin and, you know, all these terrific musicians. But gradually I discovered that, you know, the Lemon song by Led Zeppelin, which was very rude, that was actually based on a Robert Johnson tune. And making discoveries like that, you know, the Howling Wolf stuff that the Stones used to do, the Freddie King stuff that Eric Clapton used to be so good at, and his Otis Rush covers. And with like-minded friends at school who were a bit ahead of me on this sort of thing, I did find myself immersing myself in the Chicago blues. And then I was quite luckily and coincidentally at university, down this way, in fact, and University of Exeter. And I discovered in the library there that they had the most astonishing collection of blues records, all on tape, sent in by an American collector over the years. And they had 16,000 songs from pre-1941, old 78s, practically every blues song ever recorded, I think. So I listened to some of those as well.
God, that must have been a treasure when you discovered that.
That was kind of amazing, actually, and it was a bit wasted on me because I was just a fan. I wasn't studying the blues. I was just enjoying it. But, you know, obviously it's a scholarly resource. It's there for people to listen to as well as to study. So I was lucky to be able to make full use of it. I spent a lot of time looking out the window with headphones on when I should have probably been working on my English degree.
Well, you know, you wrote a book about it.
I did, eventually.
Yeah. You know, it's amazing to me how brazen some of those artists were, especially Led Zeppelin, with their songwriting credits.
I know. Wasn't that incredible?
It's unbelievable. Now, eventually, some of those guys got their due, right? They did end up... Some of the old blues guys did get their money, right?
I believe so. Willie Dixon, who had a bit of financial clout by that stage, I believe he took them to court and won and got some money for Howling Wolf, I think, or Howling Wolf's estate, maybe it was by then, because he died in the mid-70s, didn't he? But, yeah, it was the credits. You know, Eric Clapton, I've always had a soft spot for Eric Clapton. When he covered a song, you could look at the credits and find out who wrote the original.
Right.
Led Zeppelin, it was shady about them.
Oh, yeah, it was always Page and Plant. Always Page and Plant. It's like, come on, you guys, you didn't write those songs.
Exactly. It used to really annoy me. Still does.
Yes, I agree. Absolutely. So you discovered, you know, thanks to that, to Exeter, you discovered some amazing Chicago blues, and then you decided that you were gonna come here. You're going to make a pilgrimage to the home of the blues, this very city. What led you to that decision?
Well, when you're 19 or 20, you'd think anything's possible, which is good. A friend of mine had discovered an organization that made it fairly easy for British students to get a temporary working visa if they wanted to come and work for the summer in the States. And obviously, as an impecunious 20-year-old, I didn't have any money, so this was the only way I was going to be able to spend any time in the States. So I decided that I would go to Chicago, try to work in Chicago, and, you know, while working, I'd also be funding my blues habit. And that's what happened. In the summer of 79, I spent 2 months in the city prior to going on to California to meeting and staying with my uncle for a few weeks. And I worked at a restaurant called Hemingway's Movable Feast, which was a sandwich restaurant on Lincoln Park.
I know exactly what you're talking about.
Do you really? The guy there was an Englishman, the owner, Michael, and he was very nice to me. I think he liked having a fellow countryman to talk to. Mm-hmm. And he put up with me because I was useless. You know, I'd be mopping the floors, and he'd say, "You missed a bit." Oh, I'm sorry. I got the hang of it eventually, but
right.
I started not so well. And I had another job up in the northern suburbs, a telesales job at Pioneer Press, selling subscriptions or trying to sell subscriptions to their little weekly newspapers that they do up there.
You know, it's so funny, Alan, because, you know, we have a nice connection here with Pioneer Press, and I know so many people who have worked with Pioneer Press. The Daily Herald, guys at the Daily Herald was Pioneer Press, and I just find it funny that I've read most of your book, and, you know, reading in the beginning about how you actually got this job at a sandwich place that I knew of, and then you did telemarketing for Pioneer Press, I was just beside myself. Because I know those things so well.
That's funny. That's very funny. I mean, I've got a lousy memory for what I did yesterday, but I've got really clear memories of Chicago at that time because everything was so new and sparkling, and I was so young, and it was so exciting. So I can remember Pioneer Press and Hemingway's really clearly.
It's funny because you detail how, in a very short period of time, you managed to get two jobs and then a really crappy apartment in Lincoln Park.
Yeah, which I imagine is probably worth $500,000 now.
Where was it located? Do you remember, Alan?
It was 1807 North Lincoln Park West.
Yeah, that's going to be worth a lot of money today, Alan.
The great thing about writing this book 30 years after I researched it is that I could go onto Google and look at the streets. And I could look for old blues men's houses where I'd interviewed them, and I'd look for signs of clubs. And I also looked at my old address when I first went there. And, yeah, it was a bit shabby then, but it looks quite nice now.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, the time that you chose to come here, or at least, you know, like the first time you were here was in 79, then you came back in 82.
Yeah.
Very interesting time period to come here. And that's really what the book kind of is about. About that. When you got here in 79, it was a very, very interesting time for Chicago blues because a lot of the elder statesmen, the older African-American blues guys, they were either dying or they were older, they weren't playing as much, and the new breed was coming in. Is that correct, Alan?
That is correct. And the new breed were usually older than me, but sometimes not by much, and they'd listen to a lot of different music from the older guys. The older guys almost uniformly were born in the South, traveled up while still fairly young, and had plied their trade as musicians in Chicago since the 40s and 50s. Whereas the new generation were more guitarists, fewer piano players and harmonica players, because these guys had listened to, you know, soul music and funk and rock, and they had a different take on the music. And because they were coming through and they were great musicians, a lot of them, they were helping to change the scene, really. Mm-hmm.
And in the book, you talk about how many, many people believe that that blues, and, you know, Chicago blues in particular, blues in general, is a black man's and a black woman's art form, and that you talk about how many people believe that white musicians and white singers kind of have no business singing the blues. And you actually kind of believe that, don't you, Alan?
Well, I had a lot of sympathy with that viewpoint because I could see where these people were coming from. Partly, they were coming from a white standpoint and tacitly acknowledging that blues artists, since time immemorial, have been ripped off. And it just seems like appropriation, really, for a white person to sit up and sing a blues song. But the other side of it was that I have heard some wonderful music in the blues idiom played by people who happen to be white.
Yeah.
So I'm not to coin a useless phrase, being too black and white on it, really. Mm-hmm. I do tend to take the view that it's the music that matters, and if it moves you, then it moves you.
Right.
And, you know, Eric Clapton, when he's on song, he's a very expressive and wonderful player.
Yeah,
know?
There's no question about it, yeah.
But, I mean, this attitude, it was a conundrum for a lot of people. It sort of touches on this whole old chestnut thing of authenticity. And I do question in the book, what is it you're paying your $2 for? It's probably not $2 now.
No.
When you go into a club, are you paying to hear an old black guy, or are you, because he's an old black guy, or are you paying to hear some great music? And a lot of people hadn't quite got that question sorted out in their minds, I don't think.
Well,
and it tied some people in knots. You know, I had some fun with one of the records I write about, a Paul Butterfield record.
Yep, yep.
I have some fun with the liner notes on that,
yep.
Where the guy is just going round in spirals trying to justify the fact that Paul Butterfield's white.
Yeah.
Whereas then you read that and you think, geez, this is complicated. And then you put the record on and it's fantastic.
Yeah.
And then you think, well, why are we worrying about it? Paul Butterfield is a fantastic harmonica player, really good singer. And that guy on the guitar also happens to be white, Mike Bloomfield. And the rhythm section are from Howling Wolf's band. You know, who cares?
Yeah.
It's never, I suspect even now, never really been resolved in a lot of people's minds.
No, it hasn't. No, it's still a thing, Alan, absolutely. And it's an interesting facet of the book. It really is. Alan, hang on, okay?
Okay.
All right. Alan Harper is with us, and he is the author of the book, Waiting for Buddy Guy, Chicago Blues at the Crossroads. You know, if you're a Chicago Blues fan, if you've been to a lot of the blues clubs, we're going to get into his memories about being in some of the amazing blues clubs here in the city and encountering some incredible artists. You got to check out this book. It is absolutely terrific. That's harmonica virtuoso Big Walter Horton. And we're talking about the blues. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. Alan Harper is the author of a book called Waiting for Buddy Guy, Chicago Blues at the Crossroads. We have a link to the book and all the information on our Facebook page at facebook.com/Nick D Show. Alan, welcome back to the show.
Thank you.
Let's talk a little bit about, first of all, I just want you to tell a quick story before we, because I want to talk about some of the men that you interviewed, some of the performers that you've seen, and some of your favorite clubs while you were here in Chicago. But I do want you to tell the story about the customs guy at the airport and how you had to open up your suitcase and explain that to everybody.
I do remember it very clearly. It's quite funny. This was the second time I came to Chicago. I had spent the best part of a summer in 79, and then 82 I wasn't a student anymore, so I couldn't get the working visa. So I had saved up some money, and here I was to come and actually research this book. And I arrived full of excitement, and here I was in Chicago, and there in front of me was this huge guy, African-American customs agent. He said, open the suitcase. So I opened it up, and just as I did so, I remembered that I had laying out all my cassettes, all my music cassettes of, you know, Little Walter and Jimmy Rogers and Muddy Waters and Elmore James. And they were laid across. I didn't want them bashing against each other and breaking, because remember what those things were like. They used to break if you just breathed on them.
Right.
And they were all laid out flat across the case, completely covering the case. You couldn't see past them. And he said, what are you doing in Chicago? And I said, I've come here to listen to the blues. And I looked at him because I thought, this is a black Chicagoan. Maybe he's a blues musician. Maybe his dad was a blues musician. And he looked at me, and he looked at the case, and he looked at the cassettes, and then he shut the lid and said, I believe you. You've come to Chicago to listen to the blues. Next.
That is such a great story. You know, tell me about some of your favorite memories, Alan. Like we said earlier, you came at a very interesting time. So, I mean, there were times when you would go into some of these clubs and some of the legendary black musicians would just be sitting at the bar having a drink.
Yeah.
And tell me about some of those experiences.
Well, the very first visit I made to a blues club was in June 1879. And I walked up from my grubby little Lincoln Park room to Blues, which is still there, I believe, on
yes.
North Halsted.
It is.
And I pulled the door open, and there was a band down the end, and there were some booths down the side and the bar down the opposite wall. And it was very dark. And I sort of stepped in and started walking down towards the band. And my eyes were trying to get accustomed to the gloom, and the music was quite loud. And as I sort of stopped to get accustomed to the situation, and there was an old fella sitting in one of the booths, and he looked across, and I looked across, and I was quite sort of nervous, you know, because I'm 20 years old, I'm in Chicago, I'm in America for the first time. I'm in a blues club, even though I'm in a blues club on the north side, and it's all very nice, but I'm still, you know, a little bit on edge. And this guy looked at me and put his hand on my arm and said, "Howdy, Blue." And I looked at him again, and it was Big Walter Horton.
Oh, man.
And, you know, I knew about Big Walter Horton. I'd listened to his stuff, and I just thought he was a legend. He was. And but there he was. He was sitting there. He wasn't even playing. He was listening to his friends play. He was.
And that, by the way, that's who we just heard.
That was Big Walter,
yeah.
Wasn't it? Yeah. No, he was a terrific guy. And I saw him a lot of times that summer. And the blues on North Halsted was his hangout club. And when he played there. As far as I know, he didn't play in too many other places. And they really looked after him there, like they looked after a lot of his contemporaries. They loved that club. And I know Bill Gilmore, the proprietor, and Rob, his partner, were very proud of the fact that their club was a hangout for these real old, authentic Chicago blues men. But unfortunately, Big Walter died before I came back, so I never got to see him again.
Hmm.
I never got to interview him, because when I came back, I was going to, you know, get into this research business and do this book. But I never really got to interview Big Walter, because sadly he died the winter before, the previous winter.
Who were some of the musicians that were most memorable in terms of interviews for you?
I always remember very fondly Lefty Diz, who was a slightly mad, tremendously talented, vaguely alcoholic guitar player who always often put on a great show and would occasionally put on a really terrible show. He could be pretty unreliable. But he was a very charming, gentle, funny guy, a very intelligent man. And he just ripped me to shreds when I tried to interview him, because I wasn't ready, really. I wasn't prepared. He wasn't well known. There was nothing in my books about him. I had no background. There was no internet then. So I had to start by asking him about himself. You know, where were you born? How long have you been in Chicago? And all that kind of stuff. And then because I was so ill-prepared, and possibly because I was 23 years old and a bit stupid, I started making generalizations about, because we were sitting in his car outside the Checkerboard Lounge, generalizations about audiences. You know, there'd be black audiences down here and white audiences on the north side. And he just basically told me I didn't know what I was talking about. And he said, "You wait here and you'll find half the University of Chicago is, i.e. young white men, is going to be at the Checkerboard by 11 o'clock. You know, but having put me in my place, he was very sweet. And he said, "Right, I'm going to interview you now." And he did. He asked me various questions, and he couldn't keep it up. He ended up just bursting out laughing, and we just sat there and drank his bottle of old granddad for a bit.
So that's an amazing memory, Alan. Amazing memory.
He was a lovely guy, actually.
Yeah.
A great musician. I think a lot of people remember Lefty Diz. He was one of the real characters on the scene at that time.
And what were the clubs that you frequented the most, that you remember the most?
I spent most time on the north side, not because I wanted to. I mean, a part of me, because I was consciously researching a book about the Chicago blues, a part of me wanted to be on the south side and the west side the whole time.
Yeah.
But the problem with that was that there wasn't a lot going on. You could go to Teresa's, famous club on 4801 South Indiana, and find nobody there. You could go to the Checkerboard and see a band there. You know, Monday nights there'd be Lefty Diz. He had the residency at that time. But you could see Lefty up on the north side. And the problem was that you would eventually realize that although the Checkerboard and Teresa's were fantastic places to hang out, it was the real Chicago blues experience if you wanted to convince yourself of that. More music was happening in the Kingston Mines and blues and the Wise Fools, which were all within a few miles of each other, couple of blocks of each other.
Right.
And I believe they're all still there, actually.
They're
all in their original spot. And those places, particularly the Mines and blues, they had different bands every night. All the good blues was coming through there at one point or another. It might have also been in the Checkerboard, you know, once in a blue moon. But you could see the same act, you know, Lefty. You could see him at the Kingston Mines quite often.
Yeah.
The only reason, therefore I hung out in the Mines and in blues more often than I hung out in the Checkerboard. But I did go to the Checkerboard a lot because in the Reader, every week it said Buddy Guy was going to be playing there.
Right.
And so I would dutifully go down, sit there with a warm can of Old Style.
That's right.
Waiting for Buddy Guy.
And that's exactly that's exactly where the title of the book comes from.
It is.
Alan, it's a terrific book, man. And being from Chicago, it brought back a lot of memories for me. And it's really, really great. And are you ever going to come back to Chicago, Alan?
I am coming back in May because the publisher, University of Illinois Press, has invited me to come and do a signing. I think there's a big book fair going on.
Yeah.
And I might be doing some more promotion, maybe some. I think the press might be sorting out some more interviews. So I'll be there for a week in May.
Okay.
Well, and I hope to revisit some of my old haunts.
It'll be fun for you to come back, Alan.
Sure it will.
Okay. Alan, thank you so much. It was a pleasure talking to you.
I've really had fun. Thanks,
Nick. Have a great morning. That's Alan Harper. The book is called Waiting for Buddy Guy, Chicago Blues at the Crossroads.